From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. In the August edition, we brought you a rare interview with Sir Arthur Bonsall, talking about his war work with the Government Code and Cipher School, and giving us a peek behind the scenes at Churchill's most secret visit. Now we can bring you an extended version, which gives a fascinating insight into the work and atmosphere at BP during World War II. So if you could start by telling me what your work here was about.
Yes. The work I was concerned with in the German air section, first of all, was the breaking of a broadcast information by the Germans about conditions at German airfields, whether they were had got bad weather landing rules in force or all clear, that kind of thing. What they did, they set up this broadcast, which was continuous right throughout the 24 hours throughout the war, and which they listed each airfield that they either were using or might use for emergency landing, that kind of thing, to say what the weather conditions were there. And they indicated which airfields they were talking about by an encoded grid reference. They had a map grid which was used throughout the German Air Force. A typical grid reference would consist of two letters, which we call a bigram. That's not in the Oxford Dictionary meaning, incidentally. A bigram followed by a number of figures, three or more figures, depending how accurately they wanted to indicate the position of whatever it was. And the bigram was an encoding of what one could call the grid square on an ordinary map, latitude and longitude, 1 degree one way and 1 degree the other, it's a degree square. And this, they encoded this, but the position within the degree square was unclear. You know, there's a standard such as it could be divided into 27, I think, in total, but they normally use two or three. So if it said X, Y, and then 20, then that will be a fifth of the, it got quite an error, that will be a fifth of the degree, it wasn't an accurate one. And the thing was, these bigrams, with the encoding bit of it, would change every day. This was, everything changed every day in the German Air Force coding. And the job I had, first of all, was to write out these messages consisting of a bigram and a number of figures in columns and rows and that sort of thing. And gradually one noticed that some of the en clair, the figures bit, repeated from, as one would expect, day after day, they refer to the same thing, but had a different bigram in front of them. So one began to see that X, Y on one day was EF on another. That, so you've got the continuity. But the great thing was, where was it? And the thing to do, knowing it was an airfield, you've got a map, a large-scale map of France and Belgium and Holland and so on, where these airfields were. And you then, looking at it in terms of a series of grid squares, you hunted around to find whereabouts there was an airfield, an actual, a civilian one, of course, it would have been, just an old, any old airport the Germans would have adopted. And if you could confirm that, you know, there was nothing, no other degree square where there was an airfield in the position indicated by the figures, you then solved that bigram, because you knew that X, Y on a certain day meant this particular. And you gradually could, you know, day after day, doing the same old process of looking for actual airfields. We had no large-scale maps in the air sections. We had to borrow some, or not borrow. I had one of my jobs was to go and look at a wonderful collection of large-scale maps held by a bit of MI6, who was still here in those days. They kept their map collection here for a bit. But it was very useful to me in the early stages of solving this bigram system.
Did you come here quite early in the war then?
This was the first 3 months, yes, or so. First, before Dunkirk.
And you were recruited as a linguist, I gather.
There wasn't any language involved in this, but nevertheless.
No, I was going to say, that doesn't sound very linguistic.
There's very little language involved in our works, because the typical messages that were encoded, say it was a reconnaissance aircraft, would report seeing a ship, a naval ship, a British naval ship, and they would use the same map reference system, same grid system, and the message might say the German word for cruiser, and then a map reference. That's a message. You know, there's no language really involved in that. There were some little bits of German, mostly swear words, no? in this radio telephony.
But it was important information, clearly.
Well, yes, the issue collected it and sort of what it was. So that was the first system I worked on. And then another one, I went to served at Cheadle for a bit, just at the time of Dunkirk, and to reinforce the young men who were code-breaking there. Because there was a sudden rush of traffic, of course, during Dunkirk. And while I was there, I think it almost was one of the only two occasions when there was a real message involved. Mostly it was just these terrible little short things, you know, height so-and-so, direction northwest, or 180 degrees, things like that. Not sentences.
Fragments of information.
Well, relevant, but the bit that mattered, yes.
Yeah.
And one message I remember we got while I was at Cheadle was quite a long message. Well, in terms of everything else, it was a long message. And it reported that a group of German dive bombers, this was from the dive bomber headquarters, they were sending up a group of dive bombers at a certain time in the future. It was saying a future operation, and it was going to attack the troops lining up on the beaches at Dunkirk. Well, now, that was a real message, a sentence. You know, was it going to be an operation? Very valuable, but it couldn't be used because Fighter Command hadn't got enough aircraft, or rather was husbanding them for the next stage they realised was going to happen. It was the invasion of possible invasion, certainly attacks on Britain. So they weren't going to waste fighters, even though it could have, I don't know how many lives that resulted from that operation, but that was a case where we would produce something and we knew it and never got used.
That must have been quite difficult.
It was a very upsetting, that actually, that felt that, you know, we could have helped but didn't. And another one was much later in the war, during the North African campaign, when Enigma was one of the messages, type of messages they were always getting in Enigma, was various German headquarters in North Africa reporting they were running short of petrol. Actually, it's now thought that Rommel encouraged them to send messages like this, to stir the German authorities up to get some more petrol into North Africa. However, we got a message, and this was in Enigma, these messages, very important, because they frequently gave the results of the reply to it, which said the ship, a tanker, wouldn't be sailing, you know, such and such a time, and could be attacked by the British. But this time, it must have been a very out, far-flung little German headquarters. They hadn't got an Enigma, or it wouldn't work, or something, I don't know. But they didn't send the message in Enigma. They sent it in our standard code, low-grade code, which we were reading. And here was a great long message from our point of view, a real message full of, you know, we've only got 2 gallons left. Not exactly, but kind of thing. And urgent supplies needed, all that. And I got approached by the Enigma reporting people in Hut 3, who were getting lots of messages like this, and asked not to report this message, because it was in exactly the same form as the Enigma messages were, and it might have prompted someone to think, might have just been a bit dangerous for the security of Enigma. You know, they didn't want people to have it, even suspect that it might be broken. Or, at any rate, we put it by in a cupboard, never reported it. But I think those are only two actual messages. All the rest was this little fragments of instructions what to do on your raid, or reports of British RAF attack bombers. And in fact, that was the next sort of stuff I was working on. Using the same grid system, it was for general information of all German authorities, not just directed to one person. They used to broadcast the routes taken by British bomber attacks, or when they were bombing or reconnaissance, or was it British aircraft attacks on the European targets. And what they used to do, they used to look up the position of the British formation, which grid square did it form, which was the bigram to describe that. So up came my bigrams again. And the traffic, they reported when there might be 50 such grid references, which, you know, we could work out. It helped to solve the system if we hadn't solved that bit already. It plotted the course of the British attackers. So I got rather familiar with the bigram system.
And it was very compartmentalised, of course, for security. So how much did you learn after the war, when in your further career with GCHQ, about how things had all worked here? Was it sort
during
of
the Vetri?
Yes.
Nothing. We weren't interested, because there was this ban on publicity for wartime work until the 70s.
And you met your wife here, of course, and she was working on something completely other than what
Italian
you were working
naval.
Yes, so you didn't talk about that then?
No.
Amongst yourselves until it was all lifted. And did you then fill in the gaps and find it interesting to find out what each other had been working on 30 years ago, or just
no,
long gone?
No. I tended not to bother with the past, but it was really something pressing to get on.
What can you tell me about your career with GCHQ after the war?
Well, when the war was ending, when the German Air Force had ceased to operate, I was then head of the German Air Section, and my only job at the time, the only function I had to perform after the German operations had ceased, was to find out which members of the German Air Section would be interested in staying on after the end of the war with Germany to work on Japanese. So I used to approach suitable people, do you want to stay on or not? The other function I had was to make sure that as long as any German Air Force was active, to keep an eye on that. I mean, one never knew what might happen. So it was a very sort of limited function at the end of the war. And I began to get interested in the next stages. And GCNCS had set up clandestinely, in fact, without the knowledge of people working at Bletchley at the time, the beginnings of an effort on Russian. There had been some work on Russian right at the beginning of the war, but that had been closed down before the end of 1940, I think. But it didn't start again until, you know, we're in the Japanese war stage of things. And I managed to get selected to join this new party, which was eventually going to be doing the Russian. Again, I was working on low-grade codes, and one of these was used by a Russian military transport organisation, which were running lorries, streams of lorries, from Germany back to Russia, carting everything away that they could get their hands on. You know, it was well known what was going on. Well, I don't think it was very important to know. They just showed it was actually happening. It really wasn't just people saying it was happening. Here was evidence of 20 lorries in a group, or another 50 later on in the same day, sort of thing, all travelling east. And that, in fact, was the first Russian military low-grade code to be broken. And it was called Russian RUM, Russian Military 1. Then later on, they had a much more sophisticated naming system, but those days were all very crude, but RUM 1 was my work. It wasn't very difficult, actually.
But it must have helped build a picture that was part of useful information on the whole.
No, it was just practice, really.
And being very modest.
Yeah.
You were in Hut 4, I gather, for a time?
I was in Hut 4, the German Air Section was in Hut 4, until roughly the end of 1940. We then moved into Hut 10.
So were you in Hut 4 when it was apparently bombed?
Oh, yes. I was in a village on the way to Buckingham. We knew there'd been German raids. And when I got into the office that morning after it, I heard that a bomb had fallen near the hut. And in my lunch hour, I went out to have a look at the crater. And it was about 5 feet. It wasn't very deep. It was a terribly small thing. And it was at the far end of Hut 4. There was a little hut there. It's not there anymore. It hadn't got a number. I think it was just a sort of an overflow hut in case storage or whatever. I heard that it was used sometimes by the typing pool, but I never saw anybody in it. And the crater was up against it. It had made it lean backwards towards the main building. And someone came along later that day and a couple of men sort of pushed it back. So there was a basis for this story that Hut 4 had been bombed and that the whole thing had been moved off its foundation. But that's all the basis there was. Hut 4 was utterly unaffected by it.
It's quite a large, solid building, actually, isn't it? So to think that something had enough blast power to lift it off its foundations and move
Without destroying, not even breaking a window.
Yeah,
it was an impossible story. Nevertheless, it was believed. I mean, when I first got back into contact with Bletchley, it was the main item on the guide's source of information about Bletchley. Bomb on the floor.
Well, we are correcting myths all the time because of the very nature of Bletchley during the war and the secrecy. It takes people firsthand being absolutely sure, with a pin-sharp memory, that this isn't what happened, this is what happened. So, while we've got you, we have to ask you about Coventry and the myth that Churchill knew that that was coming. I gather it's a complete myth.
It is a complete myth. There's not no information relevant to the attack, but it wasn't the sort of information that could have been reported as precise evidence. There were pointers to the fact there might be activity, no date or anything accurate like that. In fact, there were several such other incidents where Enigma traffic had referred to a future raid on somewhere or other in the UK. And I think the reporting staff in Hut 3 always reported this, but it was never any value to me. I was talking to RAF Fighter Command people after. They said it was no good telling us there's going to be a raid 2 nights ahead, because the chances are the raid won't take place anyhow because the weather won't be suitable. So it's not a definite thing. And in any case, even if it were definite, what could we have done about it? You can't put aircraft up and keep them waiting for a possible arrival. You can only react to actual events. Those reports, warnings of raids on places in Britain were really of no real intelligence value.
And, of course, intelligence is, as a general business, is the stuff of myth and legend. And you only have to think of good old Ian Fleming and his fictional character that's so very popular. What do you think when you watch something like a James Bond film? Do you?
Oh, I find it most amusing. But it's in a different category from real life.
Quite.
Yeah.
I mean, there'd be so much more detail and drudgery involved in real life and much less kind of jumping off buildings.
Yes.
What's your abiding memory of Bletchley during the war?
Well, first of all, was how hard we had to work. I mean, we weren't driven by a head of section who was a martinet or anything like that, but we just knew we had to work hard because we knew the results were useful. And we felt, therefore, it was worth doing it, so we did it. And things like taking one's leave allocation. Very few, but the system was you were entitled to 1 week off per quarter. I imagine very few people ever took their full week. You know, that wasn't the part of it, was to get on with the job. So one worked very hard, weekends and all, of course. I think most people took a day off a week.
I suppose it had all your focus and it had all your energy because you being involved in something so important
has
given you real drive.
I suppose that another aspect to it was one felt that one was very lucky to have an important job that was interesting and worthwhile.
Did you ever find it frustrating that after the war, for those 30 years, this may not quite apply to you because of the career you went on to have, but a lot of people, I think, found it difficult not to be able to tell their families, especially their older relatives, their parents, how important what they'd done
was. It must have been very... In my case, of course, it didn't matter because my wife knew anyhow what had been going on. So I was spared that business of having to keep things quiet for one's own family. Though I was asked by my children what I did. And all I said, my standard reply was, I have a desk and I've got an in tray and an out tray, and someone comes in now and then and puts something in, and I take it out and read it and perhaps mark it and put it in the out tray.
And I wonder how many children know much more than that anyway about what their parents do, really.
But one felt very privileged and lucky, because after all, here we were living in a nice area of England, very rare air attack. We were not suffering from the war, so we felt we really had to work really hard, and I think most of the people did, amazingly hard. I got bits of comic poetry were written. My wife was given at the time by Patrick Wilkinson, a don from King's College, Cambridge, who wrote a poem. I forget what it now offhand. Don't remember what it was called.
It was The Other Side.
Oh, The Other Side. Called The Other Side. He left me an original. He was given, because it was referred to in it, and she got a copy from Patrick. It was given a copy by Patrick. Now, it's actually an original version. There are several copies of this poem. It's not an I've got the only copy or anything. In fact, Patterson wrote a book in which he quoted the whole thing anyhow, so it's absolutely old. But the point is, this is an actual wartime copy. It's on the sort of coarse paper which was used. Would it be of any interest for the archives here?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And it's got an interpretation, because it referred to a lot of the people without their full name and so on, but in terms of things that will be known about them, you know, describe them. So Douglas Nicol, he was a member of Hut 6, and he stayed on after the war, and he actually is quite well known as an author. He's written several of the biographies of the senior people, wartime and Bletchley. There is a famous collection of biographies, isn't it? Is it the National
The DNB, Dictionary of National Biography.
That's it. Yeah. He's a regular author in that. Well, he helped me produce a commentary on the interpretation of this poem, and that's attached to my copy of it.
Oh, wow.
So I would like to hand it over.
Yes.
Providing I'll be sure it will, you know, it'll be kept.
Yeah, we'd love to have it.
Of
Thank
course.
You.
It does mention your car, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh,
it
yes. Yes. My car was known as Boadicea. Because it looked a bit like a chariot.
Oh, wonderful.
It was that sort of thing. The line is something like, Miss Wingfield, something, 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 where she wants to go. Mm. Boadicea.
Something, yeah.
Anyways, it refers to her. Doesn't mention me as owner of the car. She has rode it.
You're incidental.
But Patrick Wilkinson was in the Italian naval section, and so he picked members of it like she was, tended to get referred to more in this than the people in Hut 4 who were only in the German air section.
You were here when Churchill visited.
Oh, yes.
What can you remember about
that? Well, what I remember about that is that there was absolutely no publicity beforehand. In fact, it was probably the reverse of that. Anyway, I didn't know he was coming, nor did any other ordinary member of this place. And it was during my lunch break. I was then, I think, working in Block A, I think. I was going for my lunch break, walking across, approaching this circular lawn from that direction. And as soon as I got inside the lawn, I noticed a group of, well, yes, young women clustered out here on the edge of the lawn. And as I came across it, I, to my astonishment, saw that they were listening to Churchill. I mean, the last thing I was expecting to encounter. And what had happened was he'd been visiting Hut 6 and Hut 8 and places like earlier in the morning. A group of girls hadn't been spoken to by him. They were just juniors. He'd been dealing with the sort of the top circuit breakers and so on. And they had all said to each other, well, we're not all going to say goodbye to him. So they guessed he would leave before lunchtime. And they had spent their lunch break standing outside there in a group. Churchill came out of the front door. His car was parked just outside these windows, Big Daimler, just outside these windows, with an ATS driver sitting in it, looking straight ahead, nowhere else. And he wasn't making an important speech. I mean, it was just an exhortation. Carry on the good work, you know, that kind of thing. And I just managed to catch the final words. And he then got down off the stone he was standing on the edge of the lawn there, straight into his car. And by the time his car reached the corner there, he was already reading documents from a big red box.
Straight on to the next thing, before he'd even left the premises.
I think he was going out to lunch at Blenheim. I guess that was it. Haven't been able to prove that, but the rest of it. I do know that he stood on the stone where that peasant one is. And my guess is, and Julie knows all about this too, after an incident in the previous year, in 1940, he came in 1941, previous year, it was a sunny day in the summer of 40, and various people were standing around on this bit of grass, and a sports car suddenly shot across it. The young man got his foot jammed on the accelerator, rolled across, fortunately not hitting anybody or anything, but the management here immediately recognised the danger that, you know, there always were likely to be people hanging around out there on the grass on a nice day, and this might happen again. So I can't remember now how many days, but my memory is they seem to have reacted very quickly to have found a source of suitable stones to put round the grass, right round it, so no car could get onto it. And later, my guess is that they'd suddenly thought of, there were some dry stone walls in the rock garden. They knocked them down and got the big stones out of the bottom, enough big stones for, say, 30 or 40 stones, something like that. The gardeners got a wheelbarrow and they wheeled them and they put them around this thing. Within days, it couldn't happen again. And it seemed to me that it'd be quite an idea to put a little memorial of this event in the form of a stone. So Judy and I, with the aid of the gardener here, were shown some possible stones which he had found in the...
Well, I think we looked at them while in the bottom of the lake, didn't we?
Yes, yes. Anyway, there were lots of stones in the bottom of the lake. And I think what happened at the end of the war, when the post office took over this place as a training establishment, they didn't want these great stones around the grass because it made it difficult to cut the grass up against a big stone. And the nearest place to dump them was back, was in the lake. So that's where, and there are a lot there now. And I think that, and hope that, restoring it to its wartime appearance will include getting these stones out of the lake, putting them back in a ring around the grass.
Well, if we do, I wonder what else we might find at the bottom of that lake.
Yes, indeed.
Good to think. Thank you.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine.